Colombia, you know, I mean, on a more macro level, just getting beyond the Clintons, the way Plan Colombia, what it did was it broke up the transportation cartels of the drug, but it diversified them, and it projected all of the violence that had been concentrated in Colombia up through Central America. So a lot of the crisis, a lot of the crisis of gangs, the crisis of crime, the crisis of drugs that has afflicted the Northern Triangle, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, is you could trace it back to Plan Colombia. It's a direct cause and effect in some ways, and you could also say the same thing about Mexico. So a lot of the disaster and chaos and misery that one sees in that corridor running from Colombia through Central America up through Mexico could be traced back to Bill Clinton's Plan Colombia and the effects and consequences of it. And then the way that Hillary Clinton it's not so much that she cap. I mean, it's not.
That,
it's
there's
not,
also a path there if you want to. I mean, that's fine. It's, but sorry.
Yeah, anybody can walk by.
No,
now.
Yeah, you're much nicer than I am. Sorry.
This is just the Clintonianism in extreme, right? The violence and the crime and the militarization as a response to that violence, and the Clintons are deeply embedded in it. Their friendship with and the promotion of the Colombian Free Trade Agreement. And
so what happened in Colombia? Why don't we have peace?
Oh, well, why don't we have peace? I mean, there's a lot of reasons for that. There was the tail end of the storm of the Hurricane Matthew.
What a metaphor, huh?
Yeah. Drove down voting. I think the right, the paramilitary right in Colombia, led by Álvaro Uribe, and this is how it circles back to Hillary Clinton. She considers Uribe an ally and a friend and an effective leader.
He is, if you value death squads.
Yes,
like,
if you value
the
death
best,
squads.
Yeah. He's your guy to
was
call.
Able to organize an opposition based on a kind of law and order. I mean, in terms of U.S. politics, we think of it as a kind of law and order conservatism and a cultural.
Sorry, it's okay. I'm not going to yell at you if you go this way. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. Especially because there actually isn't a path. So I'm like the U.S. government forcing people into
the desert.
Yeah, except it's way more hospitable right there. Okay.
And so I think the Santos government who negotiated the peace was much more effective at.
Wow, sorry, Honduran nationalists, like oligarchs, right-wing Hondurans, Uribe fans, like Manuel Zelaya haters. Wow. By the way, I should tell you that stay here. Bye, everyone listening on air. Bye. See you next week. Okay, we're keeping going now. By the way, and then we're going to open up for questions and take a break. But I met Zelaya at some weird, like...
Manuel Zelaya.
Yeah, Manuel Zelaya, yeah. Are there other ones? Like
the Honduran president?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Manny.
I thought you were talking about Vivanco.
I met them. Okay. I have personal stories that involve Zelaya, who was the president of Honduras, and then Lloyd Blankfein, who was the president of Goldman Sachs. I know it's not the president, whatever. And then... Vivanco, who was the Latin American head of Human
the head
Rights
of the
Watch.
America's
yeah.
Watch,
and this all relates to each other because, another big Vivanco fans, we get it, guys. Fill in the center. Is there like a game on? Because I don't know about. Oh, for Chapo, interesting.
For what?
There wasn't a rivalry there in it.
For what?
What? Oh, thank you. Sorry, they're your students, and I'm like harassing them. They're so worldly looking that I had no idea. And oh, good, you're moving up, guys. Move up. This is a huge deal for you. This is a privilege. Thank you. Follow the lead of what's
the
your name?
Thrill of being broadcast.
Oh my God, yeah. You have a different haircut. Hi, very funny writer. Great. Covers like Juanita Broderick. And what was your most recent thing?
Mine was on the firebombing.
Oh, my God. Wait, guys. Oh, we have two celebrities in here tonight. Well, a bunch. But two celebrities, two NCGOP-related celebrities. And they will sign their Medium articles and tweets. Because Jeeves over here. Jeff is your own.
Yeah,
okay, Jeff. And then Julia Carmel, who wrote a kind of killer tweet that said... no, it was great. Because someone was like... It was like... So you guys know about this? This is a little break of whatever, but do you guys know about the North Carolina GOP thing? That's bad pedagogy,
right?
I shouldn't do that. You can't say that. You have to say, so You can, no, you can't say anything. You assume people don't. Okay, thank you. I'm just teaching myself how to teach again. So there was this GOP office or whatever. And yeah, tell, okay, tell
okay,
us.
Okay, so you want to come up? I'm...
Just,
well, we're not on the air anymore. So
no, we're not on the air, but we are recording on live stream. So here, you know what? We can do that, and then I'm going to... Is there another... I forgot to talk. By the way, can we thank Grayson for doing the engineering here tonight? Very gracefully. And Tony Bates, and Bertold, and Melissa Ennin, and the Commons, and WBAI, and Julia Carmel. And is Jed here? Okay. Don't thank Jed. Just kidding. Yeah, do you want to, how about, well, I don't, when I open up the questions, we'll go back to that. And then people have to be in suspense about the tweet that Julia did. But, and Karina,
tweet?
I'm really sorry, it's funny, I called you Karina, because I'm embarrassed to say your name in a Spanish accent in front of other people. Not because I don't want to be like the person who's like, I'll have a guacamole. But it's also weird when you don't say that. Anyway, it's interesting. It's contradictions, nuances, levels. Okay, so let's talk about Uribe, why he tweeted against peace, which is kind of a badass thing to do. Well, no, I know, but I like that. He's just like, nah. And Uribe, oh, okay. It all goes back to the fact that I did meet Celaya at this weird Ariana Huffington-based event that was like...
Sorry.
I can't believe I got you that blurb just so you could leave early. It's no longer there. No, I still like Matt. Kind of. Okay. Zelaya was like at an event and some guy from the UN was talking to him in English that he couldn't understand. You know, you can tell with eyes, like whether someone understands what you're saying. I'm
sure. So, like my eyes right now.
No. Yeah. No, you're totally picking up what I'm putting down. No. And he was like, so I said to him, because this guy was introducing Zelaya to Jimmy Wales. Well, what is it? The guy from Wikipedia.
Jimmy Wales.
Yeah. And in English, he couldn't understand, and so I was like, "Is Jimmy Vales or something?" Maybe I even said that. I was like, "Who created Wikipedia, where you can find yourself?" And he's like, "Oh, thank you." And that was a moment. I had no idea he would be like cooed out of there, kidnapped, put on a plane. I don't know. As Hillary Clinton says, it wasn't really a coup. It just involved taking a man in his pajamas who happened to be president and putting him on a plane into another country. But that's not that like cut and dry or definitive. It's kind of like, you know, whatever, ambiguous. But so that's my story about him. Then Vivanco, who's the guy who we'll talk about in a second, who helped. He's like the American Uribe, kind of. Lots of Colombian blood to come on his hands.
Well, yeah.
I mean, you're not saying that. You're not saying that. I don't want to get you like fired from NYU. I'm saying that. And in fact, I'm going to go around the rest of my life being like, I was going to be tenured at NYU. I mean, I never taught there, but I feel like it was my saying that got me barred from the whole process. Okay. So then I met Vivanco at an event that Garzón, the judge, who was like trying to prosecute...
Baltizar Costa.
Yeah. Who was trying to prosecute Pinochet. And so I went to NYU. And he was... Do you remember he was there for like a semester?
Anyway. Yeah.
So we went out for dinner, and Vivanco, again, is the guy at Human Rights Watch who we'll circle back to. And he said something. I said something about Harvard. I think I made fun of Harvard, and I was like, well, Harvard, yeah, but look at them. They hired Samuel Huntington. And he was like, you know who Samuel Huntington is? It was like so overtly like patronizing. It was actually, I kind of appreciated it. And then I was like, yeah, I mean, we can talk about the clash of civilizations and why, like, anyone not at Harvard would be laughed out of the room if they presented that, because it's like so, was that a clap or no, just a water? Okay. Because it's just so, like, essentializing and just, anyway, racist, yeah, thank you. And then Lloyd Blankfein, so I grew up on the Upper West Side, and...
He was there, too.
He was there, not there, but he could have been there. I grew up on the Upper West Side, and he lived beneath my parents, and not socioeconomically, just physically beneath my parents. And my dad is like this mad scientist, absent-minded professor type, and he would come home from like seeing people, patients, and he would draw a bath and then fall asleep. So twice he flooded Lloyd Blankfein's apartment. Right? So that's... Class war order. And then my babysitter, who's from Mexico, actually, Ceci, there was this porter named Juan, who they had a very funny, what's dynamic banter. They would like always pull what's it called? Pranks, do pranks. And she thought it'd be funny to get like a plastic dog poop and put it in the elevator so that he would see it and have to pick it up and then he'd notice that it was like not actually real dog poop. It's better that way than the other way, right? But Mrs. Blankfein saw it first, Lloyd sure. Blankfein's wife. And so we were big disruptors of the Blankfein living style, basically class warriors. So I just wanted to share those stories because I feel like everyone here, no one wanted to miss that story, any of those. So I feel a lot better. Okay, so back to Plan Colombia, then we're going to open it up for questions. But yeah, Plan Colombia, what we did, why we did what we did, and why does Human Rights Watch, like why did Human Rights Watch something block peace in Colombia?
Well, I mean, a little bit of, just so a little bit of context. So, Human Rights. Jose Miguel Vivanco is the head of America's Watch, and he was very prominent and vocal in opposition. Not in so much. Well, yeah, I would say opposition to the peace negotiations, which put to a national plebiscite a few weeks ago, and barely lost by a very slim margin, which was a huge setback. It would have ended one of the longest wars in the world. I mean, Colombia has the largest internally displaced country in the world, more than Syria, more than Iraq. It has something like 7 million internally displaced people, and so it was quite a fascinating that America's Watch, that Human Rights Watch, would play this role. Officially, the justification was that they didn't agree with the justice provision of the negotiations of the peace agreement, which probably would have led to some form of impunity or immunity to many of the human rights violators. But you know, this was a peace negotiation that's how political conflicts.
But on both sides,
are.
Or just on the
yeah, on
side.
Both sides, on both sides. But and Vivanco's words were taken up by Uribe and amplified as part of a very orchestrated campaign by what has become a law and order and a cultural right in you know, a kind of fusion of really the worst sectors of the political spectrum in Colombia. Vivanco himself is pretty bad. I mean, he's been head of the America's Watch division for quite a long time, at least since the 1990s. He comes out of the Chilean transition. No other head of a regional division in Human Rights Watch is as political as Vivanco. He has columns in Latin America. He pronounces on politics. He is very clearly anti-left in many ways, and he has played a bad role in Colombian politics at least since the late 1990s when. I know from people who worked inside Human Rights Watch that he suppressed a report that showed that U.S. military aid was going to support the paramilitaries, and then he endorsed Plan Colombia, and then during the negotiations for the Colombian Free Trade Agreement, I know there was a movement among NGOs to place conditions on the treaty, basically metrics of X. A certain number of trade unionists were murdered, you know, then the treaty would, you know, be suspended and Vivanco wouldn't sign on to it, and which was effectively killed that effort.
It was too anti-killing?
Yeah, he didn't, he's been, America's Watch has functioned as an unofficial division of the State Department in Latin America in ways that other divisions of Human Rights Watch doesn't. So I think Middle East Watch, right. It is more critical.
Because they actually will condemn Israel.
I think there's a much more tighter transmission belt between America's Watch and the State Department.
Sorry, can anyone, like a really nice soul, ask them to be a little bit quieter in the front? Sorry, it's distracting me.
There's much more of a revolving door, as somebody once put it, between America's Watch and the State Department, and an affinity of interests and objectives that.
I wrote revolving door right here.
Revolving door, that's it.
From the NGO to the, to the G, from the non-governmental NGO, right, which is Human Rights Watch, to the
State Department. Yeah. I think a lot of people in America's Watch imagine themselves getting positions in the State Department and vice versa.
Which is weird because I feel like the people, although maybe because they're from the countries, in which case it makes sense because they're like the oligarch spawn, if you will. Not to put too normative a word on it, but you'd think that, because like most people who teach Latin American history or go into that, that's not like an easy subject when you're a right-winger to live with. Like, you kind of have to be like in denial or switch sides.
Yeah.
So it's kind of weird that would be, you know, because I do they actually do condemn like Israel for using white phosphorus, you know.
Yeah, I think there's a big distinction between Africa's Watch and Asia Watch and, you know.
God, poor Americas, huh?
Although Ken Roth, the head of the whole operation, is pretty bad too.
He's bad, right?
Yeah.
As Roth goes, so goes Vivanco. You know, the old saying.
Yeah, or the other way around.
I'm just kidding. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I think, let's open it up to questions, because I'm sure the audience is excited to.
It's bubbling with this, questions.
No, but this, I mean, yeah, I'm very excited. I think people are enjoying this. What do you mean bubbling? They may not have questions because they're absorbing it. They're taking it in.
They have questions.
Oh, look at this. We already got one. We got two. Do I get three? Just kidding. We just need two. Okay. Ben Norton. Whose name is like a joke.
Oh, exactly. And it's also relevant considering her importance in the Clinton campaign. The new Podesta emails show that...
I haven't seen that. What she's in those. She's in the emails.
And actually, a member of the Clinton campaign complained kind of jokingly that Clinton is constantly emailing Anne Marie Slaughter. So maybe you can speak
with them. I haven't seen them. I mean,
was it Nira?
Maybe you can... Maybe, I mean, it would be great. I mean,
you read them?
Have you read them? So she'll be in the administration, Anne Marie Slaughter, right?
Perhaps.
She won't be Secretary of State. No, that's no. What would she be? What do you think she would be? Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. Was writing yes in the margin with an exclamation point?
No, was to say that she doesn't like whiners, that she doesn't like people who think like their personal and family commitments might interfere with their job commitments. And then, having said this, Anne Marie Slaughter sent this, like, you know, really kind of sad, pathetic email to Clinton's people, maybe it was Podesta, saying, like, you know, I've done everything for the secretary, like, I hope I'm still in her good graces.
Really? That's great.
This is pure Washington gossip, but you can look it up.
I mean, she's at the Wilson School, right?
Yeah.
So she's a big. I mean, she's a big hawk. I mean, liberal hawk. I mean, that's how I would describe her, as a liberal hawk, right? I mean, she's somebody who will justify militarism in the name of some higher values and American.
Oh, like a humanitarian hawk.
Ideals of you know.
Especially the one of Gonzalez.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to get
Dean,
you
the Howard Dean School, right?
Did you see that thing that was on social media today about the fighter jet that was painted pink?
Oh, my God. Yeah. What was that? That's pink washing. Yeah, it's a fighter jet.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite.
All the profits from the bombing will go to breast cancer.
Yeah, what color were the what color were the bullets, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What color was the depleted uranium?
Yeah.
Well, I think that the political economy that Clinton, when we, you know, there's a lot of shorthand when people talk about, when I talk about Clintonianism and neoliberalism, but certainly the dislocation of the that we would think of as associated with Clinton, NAFTA and everything that came with it creates the economic dislocation and anxiety and inequality that is the petri dish in which Trumpism arises and is made possible, right? So so we can beat back Trump this cycle, but unless there's a fundamental restructuring of the political economy, the national political economy, if not the international political economy, then I think that whatever comes down the pike might be much worse and maybe more effective than Trump is, right? So that's what I meant by it.
What do you mean by more? Sorry, what do you mean by that?
Oh, Trump was a little bit of a fool,
oh, right?
I mean,
so you're, right. Okay, got
I mean,
it.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, Trump. I don't know how other people feel, but it seems like
it's a big Trump supporting audience, so be careful.
But it seems like no. But in terms
no,
of but his skill, it seems
right,
like
right.
If he had made that pivot, if he had somehow I mean, he could have beaten
Although,
Clinton, right? He could, I
right?
Mean,
it's like the two most unpopular people in the world.
I know. It's just amazing to watch the spiral of
Trump.
Yeah,
and even Matt Iglesias today on Twitter was like, "Oh yeah, Bernie totally could have beaten Trump." It's like, why? Wait, what? I mean,
yeah.
We knew that the whole time, but why? Okay.
Yeah.
Which I feel like he's. I was like, have you already gotten like threatening phone calls and like disinvites from canceled invitations from people? Like, you're not supposed to say that out loud, Matt. Like,
oh,
the
Matt
coven. Yeah, like the Clinton coven is going to be mad at you. Like,
yeah,
you're
yeah.
supposed to pretend.
Oh, that Sanders could have.
Yeah,
been.
Like it's not. Oh, I'm progressive. It's not that. I just want, you know, we've got to beat this guy because he's a fascist.
Well, we're entering into the phase where one can say things that you couldn't say a couple of weeks ago, because now it seems fairly...
Right, because there's no going... Yeah, yeah. I mean, Glenn Greenwald was on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he
said...
Yeah,
that was a great... That was
it was
great.
Good, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he was like, you know, the whole thing about Trump being this threat to democracy and the liberal order, that's kind of why the people who were critical of Clinton were critical of Clinton, and we were like, this is the one person on Earth who could probably lose to Trump... So maybe we should, you know, he was basically like saying people pretended that it was about the best candidate, but it wasn't. It was about the candidate that they wanted.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Clinton and the DNC, I mean, that's fairly obvious, right?
Yeah.
But there's no way, I mean.
But they both wanted a Pied Piper candidate. This is actually an interesting question, though, because, like, I remember earlier on when I was a lost soul kind of couple, like a year ago, I was like, oh, I want Trump to be, I mean, no, I still get this because I guess I think the Democrats. I don't know. Okay, I want Trump to be the nominee because he won't win. So, but I don't now go around like shaming people for not becoming like Hillary Clinton surrogates because there's a fascist threat, right? So, I guess I'm saying like I think it's ridiculous that the Democrats like and the DNC are like this is a threat the likes of which we've never before seen. If that's true, why did you want him to rise to the top?
Right.
But I mean, I'm also being honest. Like, clearly there's a strategy in that. Like, I don't expect politicians to be, like, humanitarians, but...
Right.
Anyway, just a question of where to put that, really. Yeah. You're, like, back to what I was saying before you went on this weird tangent. No. I'm serious. I'm self-chastising. I thought you were going to say Bush.
Or Reagan.
Yeah.
Take over and make all the decisions.
Wait, the what takeover? I couldn't hear it. The what takeover?
The staffers take over and make all the decisions.
But not just the staffers. I mean, Obama's been talking about this for the last couple of months, right? The national security apparatus that he... I mean, now he... I mean, he often talks with more pride about being able to have wiggled out of bombing Syria than you know, standing up to the national security apparatus. I mean, he admits that there's this shadow government. I mean, you don't have to. It doesn't have to sound as conspiratorial, but there's obviously a national security apparatus out there that has its own logic and interests and momentum and inertia that transcends whoever is in office. I think.
And that is the scariest thing of all.
Yeah.
About Trump, you mean?
No, about any.
Right.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's a personality thing, too, because, like,
yeah,
George W. Bush was, like, a famously unintelligent person. And then Obama is kind of hands-offish, right? I mean, like, he's not a great administrator. I think his biggest
right.
fans will say that. And it's actually a weird position to be in when I've often made the point, not out of any loyalty to Obama, but that, like, no, Obama and Hillary aren't the same in terms of foreign policy. But, of course, like, they're similar enough for Obama not to have – I mean, apparently, I guess they're – Hillary and Robert Gates would be on the same side of a lot of conflicts. Like, she
right,
was
right.
her and Robert Gates against everyone else, me against the world. And, but it is weird. It's like, he was the president. So, and then you have people, like, I have friends, which is weird, but, well, I won't name names, but I have friends
no
who are like, well, later. I have friends who are like, you know, hated Hillary. She's the worst thing ever, but loved Obama. And now they weirdly like Hillary. Anyway.
Ooh.
So, So, but they're
You're
like
friends with that.
We'll talk about it in a second. So, so it was really weird though because it's like, if she's this maniacal person and she's Obama's Secretary of State, is Obama stupid, or is he just asleep at the wheel or whatever? I mean, anyway.
Yeah.
But Yeah, but like.
But obviously, the ideological orientation of the administration matters, but right. within margins, so the neocons can come in and push things in a adventurous in direction that has led to catastrophe. But I don't know if a more cautious administration. So Obama has, I mean, and this is self-serving, obviously, as he ends the as he reaches the end of his term to talk about his attempts to rein in the national security apparatus. But it does seem. As if he managed, I mean, with Cuba, with Iran, with backing away from his own rhetoric about Syria, that he did try at least to contain it somewhat. But I think that you could always push it further in the realm of militarism, but you can't push it in the other right. direction.
What's the deal with TPP, by the way? Like, I don't understand, and I'm going to write about this.
Trans-Pacific
Partnership, or as Jeff Sessions called it, Trans-Pacific Apartment. But and then he corrected himself. But like, the most sordid thing I've ever seen Obama do was go on the Jimmy Fallon yeah. show and slow jam.
Oh, the slow jam about the TPP.
And it was so awful. And what was weird is like, I saw it in Vox, and it was just like, oh, look at this. Obama was on Jimmy Fallon the other day, and like slow jam. Like, it wasn't like, oh yeah, this is weird and Orwellian and sordid and like the like a parody of like the danger of being a kind of approachable, down to earth,
hip,
cool, woke, down
yeah.
guy.
Yeah, it's like Bill Clinton rapping to NAF about yeah. after. I mean, the TPP on the one level, it's the Democratic Party is obviously beholden to corporate donations, right. and the corporations want the TPP, and it's not really a trade treaty. It's a regulatory treaty, right? That enshrines the power of corporations in all sorts of mechanisms, right? It's not really. On the other hand, it's also so. On the one hand, I think that Obama, just as a good steward of the Democratic Party, probably really had dissent about that. Not just like NAFTA and every other.
He has to push it though. Like, what would happen if he didn't? What would happen? I don't mean to sound naive, but if he didn't push it, he would just like not get as good jobs and speaking gigs afterwards.
I mean, it's a good question about individual motivation. I don't know what motivates them.
I know we're good Marxists. We see the systemic, you know. But
yeah, no, but obviously he's a status driver to some degree, right. So he doesn't want to. But on the other hand, it's also geopolitical. It's about containing China, and
right.
the TPP emerges out of. I mean, this not to get too thick into the weeds, but the Latin American left. Which has now, to some degree, rolled back, managed to derail the free trade agreement of the Americas.
Right.
And the TPP, in some ways, is a response to that. It was meant to pick off the Pacific countries of Latin America from Brazil and Argentina and Venezuela and organize them in a trade, in an economic regime that would include, that would also at the same time contain China. You know, now that the Latin American left is largely exhausted, that rationale no longer holds, but I think it obviously still has something to do with China and
right.
But also the corporate funders of,
right.
of the Democratic Party want the TPP, and they're going to get the TPP
right.
in
yeah.
one form or another.
I often wonder whether they actually think it's the right thing or they don't, but they're just doing
yeah,
it. But that's also, I know, maybe it's relevant. I don't know.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We'll circle back to that, but I just wanted to because we started talking about the North Carolina GOP,
on Twitter said, "Your fascism is on the march. Let's rebuild its headquarters."
Oh, that's
right. You know, you wrote about this.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about it, and then we can yeah.
Oh yeah, sure. Is it better up here? Or
not? Oh yeah, we could. I forgot to pass the thing around.
Okay.
Do we have an extra mic? I think we can. People can hear you. Sure. Yeah. Okay.
You can have this mic.
Awesome. Oh God, I'm on the internet.
That's Corey Robbins' chat.
Oh no, sorry, Corey. My bad. I don't have as many followers as him. Yeah. So weirdly enough, last week, North Carolina and Orange County has this GOP office that gets firebombed, and it's kind of like a weird thing that happened because nobody was in the office. You know, it was just firebombed out. No one was there. Someone spray paints, Nazi Republicans, get out of town or else, and put swastika up. It's not crossed out, not like on fire or anything, not like, you know, Antifa written or whatever. Sorry for the unwoke. Apologize. And, you know, it's like, the problem is that Orange County, North Carolina, is a very blue part of that state. It's like gonna vote Democratic. It's gonna be an electoral vote for Hillary in the state that's gonna go to Trump. But, you know, at the end of the day, for the state party, it's not gonna have any use there except to try and get out the vote for Trump as much as they can. And weirdly enough, it gets firebombed, and it's all over the news, and it's shocking. All, oh my God, you know, all these leftists have gone crazy. You know, these crazed Hillary Clinton supporters have gone mad, and it's like, wow, you know, those Bernie bros, you know, they just sign up for Hillary, and it's just madness in the streets. So the liberals decided that this was our time to prove, you know, how when we go low, we go high, or when they go low, we high, low, do a barrel roll, I don't know, whatever. Yeah. So someone decided, let's start a GoFundMe. And it's a bunch of, like, bougie liberals who are pushing this GoFundMe and raise $13,000 in an hour to rebuild the office in a blank donation to the North Carolina GOP, which is like, no, you like, first of all, the office is obviously insured. B, how do you know it's not an insurance scam? Because there's no suspects. No one knows who actually did it. You know, if you remember earlier this year, there was the false flag incident of the guy burning Black's Rule in someone's lawn or whatever.
Because that's so what people write.
Yeah, because that's what black people say, you know. And just decided that, you know, we need to, you know, preserve democratic norms and delegitimize political violence because we're not like those crazy kooks in the Middle East, you know. And just threw $13,000 at the state GOP party. And if you aren't familiar with North Carolina's GOP, they're this horrifically effective organizational machine, which really just goes to show how inept the Democrats are, you know, at organizing. You know, they got House Bill 2 passed, which was the trans bathroom law. It's caused a huge spike in you know, trans hotline calls related to that. It was also a huge stripping away of workers' rights as well. So, in other words, all the Democrats did, I mean, all these liberals on Twitter trying to, like, make a statement, which no one picked up on, no one cared about, except for a bunch of angry leftist Bernie bros who needed to get out the testosterone somehow.
What was Julia's tweet?
Yeah, so I'm going to, I'm just going to wrap. Thank you very much, by the way. And I'll link to your story. Thank you, Julie. So, Julia, so one of these people, one of these, like, super bipartisan, postpartisan people who led the fundraising effort was like, point obviously isn't whether you agree or disagree with the NCGOP. It's simple. Let's respond collectively to burning down of a party headquarters. And Julia wrote, at least six black churches were deliberately set on fire by arsonists last year. Where was your crowdfunding campaign to help them rebuild? And that got like thousands of retweets. And then, which is really good. And then Ari Paul, who's not here, but you know, this is interesting. He was like, it's like 1 minute you're screaming about how we need to stop the fascists, and then the next you're giving them money
to rebuild it.
And then Julia wrote, voting third party is an irresponsible act of privilege. We must stop Trump. By the way, please give to our GoFundMe for Trump. And then Ari writes, oh, I forgot to add that the Dems are giving Trump money in a freaking swing state. So anyway, well, we are going to stick around. One thing, and then stick around because we're going to watch the debates, and also we've got to come up with some drinking games. But I'm just going to throw it out there. The first drinking game is whenever someone tries to red bait the other one. Yeah. Interesting. Thank you. Yeah. And a lot of, like, various disenfranchised groups rule. It's going to be next, yeah. Did you want to say something, Greg? Oh, yeah. No. We're told, yeah. Oh.
Radio, www.wbi.org, only on WBI you can get this.
Right.
This is the future. But on top of that, I'd like to ask a question. Being from Haiti, I've been watching the criticism of Hillary Clinton's, the Clinton Foundation in Haiti and all that stuff. Yeah, and I think it's so hypocritical because you Americans have been doing this since 1804. So this is not a Clinton thing. This is an American thing. So, like, pinning it to Hillary Clinton is so hypocritical to me. I'm not defending Hillary, obviously. But
it's not like we're a bunch of nationalists who never criticize.
Yeah.
She just happens to be running for president.
So my question to you is, does this...
Except for Bernie.
Does this focus on Hillary distracts from the American policy? Because the Republicans own the cane plantation in the Dominican Republic. And that's why they have enslaved the Haitians and brought them to the Dominican Republic to cut the cane so that they can make all the profits. They also have American troops and trained troops in the Dominican Republic that go periodically into Haiti to crash any squash any revolution. So Hillary Clinton is not doing anything different or radical. She's just doing what you Americans have been doing for the past 200 years.
I was just born here. Don't blame me. I hate this country more than, you know. Yeah,
no, that's right. I mean, I think that's right, but there's way there, and obviously when one criticizes the Clinton administration or the Clinton Foundation in Haiti, one has to step back and look at it in the broader context. But you don't have to go back to 1804 to what, you know, Bill Clinton forced neoliberalism on Aristide as a condition for restoring him back in 1994, right? And then one of his more consequential apologies. I mean, he apologized for a lot of things.
Rwanda, might be.
Did he ever apologize for Rwanda?
Was
the trade treaties that he imposed on Haiti. This was after the 2011 earthquake.
But I also think there's a major reason that we're focusing on Clinton, which is that unlike other American politicians, she has the mantle of being a feminist and being a, what did you call her before? You said like the representative of the dispossessed or something. Like no one, in other words, there's...
The deplorables.
Well, the deplorables too, but you said something about dispossessed, didn't you?
Well, just when she positions herself as a populist.
Right, well, as a populist, right. So like there's a facade and a charade that I think happens with Clinton that doesn't happen with other, I mean, to a certain extent it happens with Democrats.
Right.
Writ large. But I think it happens more with Clinton because she's a, you know, she positions herself as a feminist, and she's been very good about optics. Most divisive, disgusting way where she is like, oh, well, if we get rid of the banks, is that going to end racism? And people are like, well, no, and Sanders wasn't saying that. But it's also not totally, like, class and race and economics are not totally unrelated.
I mean, it'll be interesting to see if the neoliberal... feminism is enough to silence criticism of her military, you know, what will be horrible.
They will try, and I know that because...
I mean, it did under Obama, right? I mean, but that's because I think the vitality of the Obama coalition, it didn't have to be coerced and blackmailed into voting for Obama, right? There was a coherence to the coalition that won Obama the White House in 2008 and re-election in 2012.
It was not a forced enthusiasm or optimism. It was legit prediction or not.
Right.
Yeah.
And obviously there should have been much more opposition to the militarism that Obama did preside over, the drone wars, the extrajudicial killings, the counterinsurgency, the Libya, than there was. There was silence among the liberal leftists. It'll be interesting to see. But I think that silence was more... I think it was more natural.
I don't know.
And we'll see it, to the degree that people will be quiet under a Clinton administration in the name of, you know, the Democratic Party or liberalism.
I think that with Obama, because there was, you know, it's ironic that Bill Clinton is the person who accused the Obama campaign of playing the race card. Like,
Michael Eric Dyson.
He said, I remember once on MSNBC, he was like, And he was Obama. His wife was Hillary in 08. But he was like, Obama runs from race like a black man runs from the police. Like, that was his quote, and he's a big Obama person. And, like, the difference between Obama and race and Hillary and gender is significant, I would say, especially among her surrogates, right? Like, they push the gender narrative so hard, and it's actually pretty, like, exploitative and disgusting. And as a feminist, I find it really, hijacking, right? And cynical. But I do think that with Obama, it was more kind of like we all witnessed the racism, and we had never seen that really before. I mean, no, we've seen racism, but we never saw a president. We've never seen a female president. But we had never really seen this disrespect that we saw people say, oh, with Clinton too, but it was different. It was like literally like a you don't belong in this house that you're living in. And so I do think that there was a lot of self, not self-imposed even, but it felt natural. I was just like very protective of him. And
right.
I don't think, my hope is that people won't be that way with Clinton because she's so cried wolf over sexism and feminism. And also because I do honestly think that with Obama, I was like, yeah, he's problematic, but like we'll never elect someone who's less centrist than he is. And then having Sanders around, it really is. And I know, call me a Bernie bro or call me whatever, messiah complex, I don't care. Like, it really was like, oh, there's someone way to the left. And not even, I don't like when people are like, it's not left or right. It is left or right, but it's also just extra, like, outside of establishment and elites. Like, there's someone really out there who was so viable and probably would have won the primary and then would have won the general more effectively than Hillary, but if the DNC weren't against him. And my hope is that, like, that will make this gap in expectation where, like, before I was like, yeah, Obama, of course he's killing innocent people. Of course he's doing this, that, the other, but, like, he's the president of the United States. What else could happen? And I feel like because Hillary won, but we saw a Sanders possibility, and it wasn't like a LaRouchean statistic. Like, it was really a viable person, and LaRouche sucks, but whatever. My hope is that that will, like, really create the expectation and the gap that will make people feel motivated to not just accept the status quo.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, the Sanders, the fact of the Sanders insurgency or campaign is evidence that the Obama coalition is straining and falling apart. I mean, it came back together in the face of the threat of Trump, but it's not it's not going to naturally continue. It's the economic pressures are just too great, I think.
Well, thank you. Can you talk to him after? Or does it need to be a 30-second question? Or if it's a comment, just do it after. But if it's a question.
Okay. Trump said the election was rigged. We know what he means by that is his idea of really organizing kind of a right-wing populist neo-fascist opposition, and he's not going to concede once he loses the election. That's a fact. However, isn't it true in a sense that the election is, in fact, rigged? And shouldn't that be a rallying cry for the left? I leave that to you.
I mean, one thing I will say is that I have a fear of conspiracy. I have, like, conspiracy theory defensiveness, and I'm being, like, honest. This is self-criticism. Like, with the Juanita Broderick thing, people are always like, oh, well, that's crazy. What are you talking about? And the only reason that I actually had her on my show, and I need to play the interview, which is kind of another thing. Part of me just wants to wait until the election, because I want to play it and show that Clinton is probably a rapist. And none of my feminist friends who call me like a misogynist, self-loathing, whatever, can like ever accuse me of anything, because I'll just be like, you know what, I wait until after the, again, I'm not like the ruler of the world, but whatever, to the extent that I would publish something, because also, if I gave it to like Breitbart, they would like be very excited. Okay, but I'm not doing that because I'm not a right-winger, because there are people who are oddly enough critical of Hillary who aren't right-wing, it's weird, or haven't internalized misogyny. But my thing is that, like, the only reason I really went there with the Juanita Broderick thing was because, thank God for small favors, and this woman from Wonkette, Rebecca Commie Girl, ironically is her name, very loose usage of that term, she did that thing where she was kind of like, yeah, I think Bill Clinton probably raped her, but that doesn't make you a bad feminist. You can rape someone and be a feminist as long as you, like, stop raping them. And, no, really, I'm not exaggerating. And she was kind of like a Trump because she said a lot of the stuff that people were thinking and everyone freaked out. But it was great because, like, no one could, thanks to that, like, just like people kind of couldn't turn away from certain problems because Trump, like, blew the lid off of them, it was like No, it's not a conspiracy theory anymore to like entertain the narrative of a woman if we believe women, right? Like there's this whole mantra based on the fact that by default we believe the women unless they're critical of the woman who's running for president's husband. But anyway, so I have to admit, like, I haven't pursued that enough because I do feel I have this fear of being associated with conspiracy theorists and I don't have the time to research it. So I'm just like, there's so much other stuff to talk about. I'll just stick with that, which isn't defensive. Grayson.
The people who ask me the questions on the radio, they can't hear you, so you have to walk up to the mic and ask the questions.
Oh, okay. Well, I asked for another mic, but anyway, what's the learning curve? This is the first time we're doing it live. I think, though, we're going to... I want you to respond, though.
Oh.
He's a poll watcher, so... No, I'm kidding, but that'd be fine. Poll monitor, whatever.
I mean, when Trump says the election is rigged, doesn't he also mean the
Berthold, we're responding to his question. So
no, not really. I mean, I don't know.
I know, but
answer.
I want to listen because if not, I would have asked someone. No, to his question. He already asked it, so I want him to hear the response.
When Trump says the election is rigged, I mean, aside from the prepping for some kind of, brown shirt, reaction on the street, isn't he also just criticizing the media? In some ways, it seems like he's more talking about the bias of the mainstream media.
To set himself up.
Yeah, they keep reporting negative stories about me.
Right.
I mean, it seems like more whining than anything.
Well, what's weird, though?
He is subverting the legitimacy.
No, I know he's doing it.
Yeah,
I know
but
he's
which
doing.
Is, I mean, this is the weird thing. This is the other drinking game. Take a shot of vodka every time someone red baits someone, but also take a, like, mouthwash or something every time Trump says something that, like, he's saying for the wrong reasons, but you kind of agree with. Like, when he's like, you passed NAFTA, or, like, you call them super predators, or you're pro-TPP, and you're like, yeah. Oh,
well, Putin. Where's the Moscow gold?
I did promise Greg, yeah. We were talking about whether or not, like,
she promised
me
a bag of Moscow gold.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We are taking our orders from Putin. Uh-oh, we have a Putin person here, yeah. My thing is, like, I don't care. I don't care about... People are like, you're a Putin lover. I'm like, no, I'm actually not. I just think you're weak sauce intellectually when you have to turn to an unfounded conspiracy to smear Donald Trump. It's not
where's
like
the
man
gold?
Hasn't
the
like
gold?
Bragged about assault. Yeah. You and then Ben, yeah. Major agitation, yeah. Yes, you. Yeah, yeah.
No, because we at BAI, we had this whole benefit. The best democracy money can buy with Greg Palast, and the thing is rigged. I mean, and Trump's narrative ties right in with the Fox News narrative, which his supporters watch and which supports him, that they have eliminated tens of, how many of you saw that movie, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy? Did you see it? It's worth seeing because he documents how there is a campaign to eliminate voters all across the country, and he got a hold of the secret list and followed it up, and they have eliminated people who have, as if they're voting in two states, when really they have, their name isn't even the same. It'll be like Thomas G. Moore, Tom W. Moore or something.
Or it'll be like Maria Hernandez, and there are a lot.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. So it is rigged. So when he says that, people hear that because Fox News has been promoting that line all year. So he's playing right into that. That's the rigging he's talking about, which is actually true.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We're gonna watch the debates because they start in 15 minutes. And Greg will be here. Oh, yeah. I'm descending though, because I have to go to the bathroom. But honestly, yeah, Tony Bates, welcome. My intro to what? To go in the bathroom? My bladder's full. It's feeling very full. No, stick around. Thank you for coming. Support the show, support the station, and support the comments. And thank you so much for Greg Randon. Greg Randon, it's a big deal that he gave so much of his time. He could be on round tables till the cows come home. Oh my God, you were. Go run. Run and go to Democracy Now.
Katie invited me.
You
could have.
You know, it would have been a great, like, you know.
I said I can.
Thank you. I blame your friend. No, but really, where can people find you online? GregRandon.com and Greg Randon on Twitter. But yeah, he's really more of an. A real life person, yeah. But thank you guys, and sign up for the listserv. I don't even know what for. Get drinks, tip your bartender, because we still live in the capitalist world system, unfortunately. Oh, thank you. Yeah, Greg is really funny. You should befriend him on Facebook or follow him on Facebook. You look like Gael Bernal Garcia. Has anyone told you that? No? The Mexican act, Gael Bernal. This, okay, then we would put on music if we were... I don't know. You guys are like... No, go. All right, we haven't worked out the finish. The kickball chain. All right, thank you. Thank you, thank you. And listen to Tony. And yeah, follow... Greg is very funny. Yeah, thank you. No, but really, thank you. Thank you. Sorry, this was the most awkward ending. I'm sorry. Thank you.
I'm paying you. Wait, don't go away.
Thanks, folks, for coming in. Thanks for being here. And for those of you listening online or on the air, remember to pledge in support of Katie. The debates will be coming up on WBAI shortly, and if you're here in the Commons, they'll be coming up right here in front of you. But dial us at 516-620-3602. Pledge your support to this station. It's kind of a one-of-a-kind thing, folks. The Commons is a place where Brooklyn and New York gets to come and experience free speech, and WBAI 99.5 is the same kind of place, and that's why Katie is on our airwaves. 516-620-3602, or visit givetowbai.org. Thank you so much for coming in tonight, and with these two folks, I can't support the election process. Forget about a candidate. I can't support the process at this point. So if y'all can, have at it, enjoy, vote for whomever you choose. But for me, it's rough. Anyway, if you don't know, or if you came here for some other reason, Katie Halper's show can be heard on WBI on Wednesday nights, 7 p.m. Katie is incredibly engaging, incredibly entertaining, incredibly funny. We want you to tune in on WBAI.org or 99.5 FM here in New York to hear the kind of analysis and coverage that you won't hear. One of the things I love about Katie's show is, while, as she has pointed out throughout this conversation, she is not necessarily a supporter of Donald Trump, she has to point out the inequities on the other side as well, which is our side. And from my perspective, we fell down as the left when Barack Obama was elected. We didn't hold him to account. We didn't call him to account. And we didn't make him do what we thought he was going to do. And so in this case, I'm proud to say that, particularly with millennials, like Ms. Halper, particularly with millennials, folks are saying this process isn't working after what happened to Bernie Sanders. I can't support this. My candidate was stolen from me. And at that point, or once Bernie was gone, many people became so disaffected that they decided they weren't going to participate anymore. Hey, my phone's ringing while I'm live on the radio. Isn't that great? But if you have either one of these perspectives, hey, look, it's my baby mama. Anyway, that was a little joke. But anyway, folks, you can hear Katie every Wednesday night from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. on 99.5 FM or at WBAI.org. Come up, Katie, join me. Come back up. Let's talk about these two folks, this Clinton and Trump folks. They're not here to see me. They're here to see you.
Okay, well, we're going to be watching the debate soon. I just
microphone first.
No? Oh, yeah, I don't want people to leave because they were promised debates. Sorry you were promised Jill Stein, but that was not in my control.
Listen.
When we see her on there, wait, we gotta stop. We gotta let the people watch, no?
No, the debate hasn't begun yet, but it will in just a few minutes.
Pre-debate.
Yeah, it's pre-debate. Well,
that can also be effective. Anyone get that? That's gross. Thank you. I need something to eat, though.
Yeah, but Ms.
Okay,
Halper,
yeah.
In about 9 minutes, you'll get something to eat. It will be a Trumpy and or Clintony. Chunky, all the same, but decide what you want to eat. 9 more minutes. We'll be fine.
Okay. So wait. But we're not on the radio right now, so we're just...
No. We are actually on the radio right now.
Oh, yes. It's so good to have
I wouldn't
open
be
lines
here if we weren't on the radio.
No, Melissa, come up.
We have microphones. Of course we're on the radio. And have
well, I thought we were just live streaming.
No.
You guys, this is why you have to believe in WBAI, because where do you see the fourth wall, not just ripped down, but literally, like, certain verbs. I want to use verbs that I can't. But
and
like,
in black and white.
Black and white, how so?
Never mind, Katie. Anyway, that's a joke from the 90s that she didn't get.
I kind of did, maybe, yeah.
Okay, well, play along.
Okay, well, so, that's a dangerous terrain.
Well, anyway, so if you're out there and listening on the radio
online, I have a new time slot. I didn't even
don't
know.
Don't forget that we are a non-commercial free speech radio station.
What?
We don't have commercials because...
Pull down the screen? Why? Because it's... Oh, okay. Yeah, we have to
now
do
we're
that,
talking
yeah.
to the audience, but since we're live on the radio, we can't talk to the audience. But
yeah, I know.
What
this
I wanted to say
was... This
is
interesting multimedia. We're drawn in different directions. I just have to get out of the blinding thing
yeah.
in my eyes.
All right, folks, here it comes. So
but yeah, keep talking.
Yeah.
Who is that guy? He looks like Bill Moyers. Don't worry, we're not doing this
he
during the
like
debate.
He looks like Bill Moyers and Bernie Sanders had a kid.
Which
maybe.
Will, yeah.
Whomever he is. We're watching New York 1 in case
have my glass of wine at the ready
about.
Debate night. Who's Kate Morgan Jackson? Oh, guys, hashtag, use the hashtag Katie Help Show. Why not?
Yes.
Katie Help Show, hashtag.
That's KT.
Letter K, letter G,
H-A-L-P-S, right.
Yeah. And then, oh. What? What's Trump's tweet? What did it say, Ava? By the way, we have a guest in the audience. Can I shout you out, or are you off duty? This is Ava Farkas, who is our premier debut guest on the first episode of the Katie Halpert Show. She happens to be the executive director of the Metropolitan Council on Housing, the oldest and biggest New York City housing organization.
Thank you for
being
here.
Yeah, and she's a very sought-after commodity. It's weird. I've known her since I was five, but people are like, oh, you know her? I need her endorsement. I'm like, Ava? What?
Auntie
she's
Ava?
She's late all the time. She's even later than me. Just kidding. She's an award. She got a People's, what was it? People's Daily? Workers Daily Worker? What is it? No, the Communist newspaper. Workers World. Oh, I think we should watch MSNBC because, let me tell you why. Greg, I forgot to bring this up, but this is my theme of every show except for, which is like how I like was a leftist who kind of rolled my eyes at people who were like, I'm left, not liberal. I was like, whatever, Bush is president, who cares? And then Obama was president. I was like, yeah, it's kind of a thing. And now it's like, wow, it's really a thing. But I don't like to be self-righteous about it, but it is a thing. And so the way you know that it's a thing is when you watch Democracy Now! And you feel at home and you watch MSNBC and you feel, like, disgusted. That's my litmus test. So I say we watch MSNBC because Fox is too easy. Like, yeah, obviously, they're like, oh, Santa and Jesus Christ were white. We know that because we're Fox.
Well,
like, no one
true,
takes that
right?
seriously, I guess, apparently. That's easy. In fact, I look back on some of my writing and comedy from a couple years ago, and I was like, what was I doing? Like, what a waste. Like, I need to convince New Yorkers that, like, Fox News was stupid.
Yeah. Everyone grows, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But
hey, they go low,
which,
we go high.
Let me say as well, you brought up Democracy Now! WBAI is the station where Democracy Now! Was born and founded. Amy Goodman worked with us in our, not in this studio, but at 120 Wall Street, at the other studios. Amy Goodman, it started at WBAI and began, Democracy Now! Began at our station. And because so many of you, and yeah, you can clap for that. You should clap for that. And because so many of you and people like you pledged your support to this station, Democracy Now! Can be heard nationally on over 1,000 radio stations.
That guy used to be a TV.
And on television stations. And that's thanks to all of you.
Yes.
So we appreciate that.
And I'd like to
we're hopeful that you're going to make Katie Halpert also that available to the rest of the U.S.
Yeah, I like to think of myself as the democracy later, because I'm an evening show. Social democracy later, social democrats later.
Social democracy later.
It's just they're changing it. Wait, it flashed again. Uh-oh, it's the media rigging that Trump... But that is a weird thing that happens. Do you ever find yourself being like, yeah, Trump? Not like, yeah, Trump, but like, yeah, what you're saying, and then you're like, wow, Trump is saying that. But we all know that because it's
absolutely.
Like the Lou Dobbs phenomenon. It's like Bernie Sanders, people love saying, oh, Bernie Sanders is illegitimate because he appeared on Lou Dobbs or once agreed with Lou Dobbs. But anyone who knows about trade is like, there's a mixed trade strange bedfellows.
Yeah, but is
look
any, is any
is
of the media
did,
trustworthy?
Did Trump submit to that? I don't feel like that's a real photo of Trump. Ava, do you think that's a real photo of Trump? I feel like that's like apparent, like, that's like the Democrats designed that face thing, and he was asleep at the wheel, and he was like, yeah, sure, use that weird thing of me and a lion, like, morphed, a lion-Trump morph.
Well, there's a lot of airbrushing on both of them, I'd say.
Yeah, maybe.
So we're going to get out of your way in a moment, folks. Oh, we're going to let the debate happen,
yeah.
And Katie's really excited about that.
And we're going to bring you Jill Stein, don't worry, guys, because she's sick, but don't remember, she's she's sick, kind of, but she'll be online probably. But
you know, I took a photo with Jill Stein right over there about a month and a half ago.
She was here for
check
what?
Check my
for
Instagram
what?
Page. I'm not sure why she was here, but and you know what's funny? I didn't recognize her first. Her press secretary worked with me in L.A. for years, and so I said, "Hey, Maliza, look,
oh,
there's Jill Stein."
I was in touch with Maliza. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Of course.
Who's friends with Susie Weiss?
It's Susie Weissman.
Susie Weissman, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, okay, weird.
I worked with them for about 7 years.
She's here this semester.
Yeah, so Susie Weissman, blah, blah, blah.
I was trying to get her on.
Connected
she's
to the Pacifica
Soviet
Network.
Tip.
By the way, folks, we are a part of the Pacifica Radio Network, and if you don't know who Pacifica Radio Network is, we are the network that invented the send your money in and we'll give you good programming, PBS does, like NPR does.
Oh, we invented it?
We invented that model. We're the first people to ever do that. And they borrow. In fact, NPR was invented in our radio station in Los Angeles.
NPR. Oh, Lopez. Is that who was Brian?
Created at KPFK in Los Angeles. And here's the great story. The woman who began NPR.
They're not paying it forward. Is all I'm going to say.
She fired a bunch of producers and hosts, and then rehired them at a new network, and NPR began. So anyway, 2 minutes left, folks. We're getting to the debate. Last call for you to pledge in and support WBAI 99.5 FM. There's only one voice like ours. There's only one Katie Halper, and we're glad to have
people
her.
People try to get this nasal New York je ne sais quoi. Oh, here. Okay, we got a Wallace.
On
the stage.
That's hilarious.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here, folks.
See you next
Thank you for pledging your support. 516-620-3602. Visit givetowbai.org. Thank you, Grayson Challenger. Thank you, Rezzy Johnson. Thank you, Max Schmid. And thank you, Katie and Greg. Peace, y'all. Enjoy the debate.
And yes, indeed, we will be picking up the Democracy Now! Added debate coverage as soon as it begins. You are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial WBAI in New York City, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. We took a two-hour break from our fundraising for the fall of 2016 to bring you live from two flights down in the Commons, the Brooklyn Commons. Get the Katie Halper Show live. She does it once a month. You might want to follow her tweets or check out WBAI.org to find out when the next live event is with Katie Halper. It was a packed house downstairs. And we are monitoring now the Democracy Now! Feed so that when the debate begins, we will go to it and bring it to you, the enhanced coverage coming to you from Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! In the meantime, though, an announcement or two as we await the debate.
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Join us this Thursday, October 20th at 10 p.m. for a very special Best Of edition of The Sweet Spot. We'll be putting the fun back in fundraiser with interview excerpts from Roy Ayers, Femi Kuti, Patrick Adams, Breakbeat Lou, and Revive Music's Megan Stabile, plus special guest host Miss Jeannie Hopper from Liquid Sound Lounge fame. Only on WBAI 99.5 FM. Listener sponsored community radio.
Don't you worry, baby. The best is yet to come.
Grab our hand and help WBAI blossom. To help us create more extraordinary and unforgettable shows. Just like you were there for your friend who needed a self-esteem boost before the high school prom. We need you to become a BAI buddy. When you become a BAI buddy, you help us become grounded, stronger, and resilient through these shaky financial times. As a BAI buddy, you can donate any amount of your choosing on a monthly basis. In return, you will receive membership benefits and discounts at local businesses, as well as a signature WBAI tote bag. To become a BAI buddy, or for more information, go to givetowbai.org. Join us today and help our dreams grow.
Los Penas. The WBAI Community Advisory Board is holding open meetings for all to attend on the first and third Sundays at the atrium at 60 Wall Street in New York. So, what's the cab? Well, we advise management on programming and we volunteer and help out at the station. So please come, bring all your questions and your opinions. And again, that's on the first and third Sundays of the month at the atrium at 60 Wall Street, New York.
New York, New York.
And we are going to throw it over to Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, and the coverage of the third and final presidential debate
Chris Hedges, coming to you from Las Vegas. Booby of 350 Action. The presidential debate is just about to begin, which is moderated by Fox News's Chris Wallace. He just has the teleprompter in front of us and in front of him, and he looks like he's about to begin reading those words. What we see right now is an empty stage.
From the Thomas and Mack Center at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I'm Chris Wallace of Fox News, and I welcome you to the third and final of the 2016 presidential debates between Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Donald J. Trump. This debate is sponsored by the Commission on Presidential Debates. The Commission has designed the format, six roughly 15-minute segments with two-minute answers to the first question, then open discussion for the rest of each segment. Both campaigns have agreed to those rules. For the record, I decided the topics and the questions in each topic. None of those questions has been shared with the Commission or the two candidates. The audience here in the hall has promised to remain silent. No cheers, boos, or other interruptions so we and you can focus on what the candidates have to say. No noise except right now as we welcome the Democratic nominee for president, Secretary Clinton, and the Republican nominee for president, Mr. Trump. Secretary Clinton, Mr. Trump, welcome. Let's get right to it. The first topic is the Supreme Court. You both talked briefly about the court in the last debate, but I want to drill down on this because the next president will almost certainly have at least one appointment and likely or possibly two or three appointments, which means that you will, in effect, determine the balance of the court for what could be the next quarter century. First of all, where do you want to see the court take the country? And secondly, what's your view on how the Constitution should be interpreted? Do the founders' words mean what they say, or is it a living document to be applied flexibly according to changing circumstances? In this segment, Secretary Clinton, you go first. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you very much, Chris, and thanks to UNLV for hosting us. You know, I think when we talk about the Supreme Court, it really raises the central issue in this election, namely, what kind of country are we going to be? What kind of opportunities will we provide for our citizens? What kind of rights will Americans have? And I feel strongly that the Supreme Court needs to stand on the side of the American people, not on the side of the powerful corporations and the wealthy. For me, that means that we need a Supreme Court that will stand up on behalf of women's rights, on behalf of the rights of the LGBT community, that will stand up and say no to Citizens United, a decision that has undermined the election system in our country because of the way it permits dark, unaccountable money to come into our electoral system. I have major disagreements with my opponent about these issues and others that will be before the Supreme Court. But I feel that at this point in our country's history, it is important that we not reverse marriage equality, that we not reverse Roe v. Wade, that we stand up against Citizens United, we stand up for the rights of people in the workplace, that we stand up and basically say the Supreme Court should represent all of us. That's how I see the court and the kind of people that I would be looking to nominate to the court would be in the great tradition of standing up to the powerful, standing up on behalf of our rights as Americans. And I look forward to having that opportunity. I would hope that the Senate would do its job and confirm the nominee that President Obama has sent to them. That's the way the Constitution fundamentally should operate. The president nominates, and then the Senate advises and consents or not, but they go forward with the process.
Secretary Clinton, thank you. Mr. Trump, same question. Where do you want to see the court take the country, and how do you believe the Constitution should be interpreted?
Well, first of all, it's great to be with you, and thank you, everybody. The Supreme Court, it's what it's all about. Our country is so it's just so imperative that we have the right justices. Something happened recently where Justice Ginsburg made some very, very inappropriate statements toward me and toward a tremendous number of people, many, many millions of people that I represent, and she was forced to apologize, and apologize she did. But these were statements that should never, ever have been made. We need a Supreme Court that, in my opinion, is going to uphold the Second Amendment and all amendments, but the Second Amendment, which is under absolute siege. I believe if my opponent should win this race, which I truly don't think will happen, we will have a Second Amendment, which will be a very, very small replica of what it is right now. But I feel that it's absolutely important that we uphold because of the fact that it is under such trauma. I feel that the justices that I am going to appoint, and I've named 20 of them, the justices that I'm going to appoint will be pro-life. They will have a conservative bent. They will be protecting the Second Amendment. They are great scholars in all cases, and they're people of tremendous respect. They will interpret the Constitution the way the founders wanted it interpreted, and I believe that's very, very important. I don't think we should have justices appointed that decide what they want to hear. It's all about the Constitution and so important, the Constitution the way it was meant to be, and those are the people that I will appoint.
Mr. Trump, thank you. We now have about 10 minutes for an open discussion. I want to focus on two issues that, in fact, by the justices that you name, could end up changing the existing law of the land. First is one that you mentioned, Mr. Trump, and that is guns. Secretary Clinton, you said last year, and let me quote, the Supreme Court is wrong on the Second Amendment. And now, in fact, in the 2008 Heller case, the court ruled that there is a constitutional right to bear arms, but a right that is reasonably limited. Those were the words of the judge, Antonin Scalia, who wrote the decision. What's wrong with that?
Well, first of all, I support the Second Amendment. I lived in Arkansas for 18 wonderful years. I represented upstate New York. I understand and respect the tradition of gun ownership. It goes back to the founding of our country. But I also believe that there can be and must be reasonable regulation. Because I support the Second Amendment doesn't mean that I want people who shouldn't have guns to be able to threaten you, kill you or members of your family. And so when I think about what we need to do, we have 33,000 people a year who die from guns. I think we need comprehensive background checks, need to close the online loophole, close the gun show loophole. There's other matters that I think are sensible, that are the kind of reforms that would make a difference, that are not in any way conflicting with the Second Amendment. You mentioned the Heller decision, and what I was saying that you referenced, Chris, was that I disagreed with the way the court applied the Second Amendment in that case, because what the District of Columbia was trying to do was to protect toddlers from guns. And so they wanted people with guns to safely store them. And the court didn't accept that reasonable regulation, but they've accepted many others. So I see no conflict between saving people's lives and defending the Second Amendment.
Let me bring Mr. Trump in here. The bipartisan Open Debate Coalition got millions of votes on questions to ask here. And this was, in fact, one of the top questions that they got. How will you ensure the Second Amendment is protected? You just heard Secretary Clinton's answer. Does she persuade you that while you may disagree on regulation, that in fact she supports a Second Amendment right to bear arms?
Well, the D.C. versus Heller decision was very strongly, and she was extremely angry about it. I watched. I mean, she was very, very angry when upheld. And Justice Scalia.